This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. And in this segment, we're going to shift our attention to India, U.S. relations with India, in light of the visit by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh to the United States, which, by the way, is the first official state visit of the Obama presidency. And in this half hour, we're also going to look at the recently released report, which was issued by the Bay Area Council on emerging ties between the San Francisco Bay Area and India, which, along with China, is the world's fastest growing economy. First, we want to go down to Stanford. Rafiq Dosani is Senior Research Scholar, Director of the Center for South Asia at Stanford University, and he joins us by phone. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess a good place to begin is by asking how significant this state visit is. As I said, it's the first visit. It's a couple of new administrations, clearly a lot of photo ops, looking for better ties between the U.S. and India. What do you suppose has served in this?
My sense is that it's important. You know, this administration has signaled as best it could that it values India as a partner. That said, you know, U.S.-India relations have begun poorly under this administration. You know, I think the Indians are particularly upset because they expected continuity with the early administration, and that hasn't happened. So it's a time to sort of look at this, repair things. I don't think people really realize how open the U.S.-India relationship actually is. You know, there aren't too many hidden agenda. It's not a strategic relationship in that sense, you know. But it's making great progress if you look at trade, if you look at civil society and so on.
Well, you use the word repair. When we talk about repair, I guess we're talking about perhaps the United States getting closer to Pakistan and China?
Well, what's happened is, I think, a change in priorities. I mean, Obama thinks that he administrated, you know, he inherited, and, you know, and many would agree, a big mess when he took office. And these messes included Iraq, you know, the AFPAC problem, the Middle East, climate change, healthcare, energy, education. I mean, if one was to put his priorities down, that's the list. Now, to where does India fit into this? You know, it's because of the immense failure of regionalism in South Asia. Relations between India and its neighbors are either very bad to moderately good. You know, it's not good with Sri Lanka. It's sort of always patchy with Bangladesh, trouble with Nepal. So from that point of view, where does India stand in this list of priorities? And I don't see it there.
Well, President Obama said, and I'm quoting directly, the relationship between the United States and India will be one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century.
Well, that's what I was trying to allude to earlier, that this is actually a very interesting relationship. It's not strategic in the sense that you have a thick web of political, economic, cultural, and so on relationships at this point. You know, India, for one thing, is not at that stage of development where it can be part of a thick web of relationships. But at the same time, it's very open. You know, if you look at, for example, that, say, scholarship in the field, in several fields, there's no comparison between what's going on between the U.S. and India, which is way, way ahead of what's happening between, say, U.S. and China. If you look at political science studies, economic studies, the single largest category, for example, of PhD students in political science are studying India.
So I'm hearing both optimism and pessimism in your remarks. I mean, or maybe optimism and some skepticism about what kind of relationship can be forged.
Yes, yes. You see, the thing is, I think in the short term, over the next 2 or 3 years till the U.S. gets out of its problems in economic problems, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so on, India has very little role to play. On certain things like climate change and so on, it's actually on the other side, if you look at trade openness also. So actually, it's on, you know, it takes a negative position to the U.S. So I think these are short-term issues that will take 3 or 4 years to get resolved, and India should be prepared to say, well, let's just go along with the situation as it is and focus on trade.
We thank you, Rafiq Dosani, for giving us your point of view. And again, Rafiq Dosani is Senior Research Scholar, Director of the Center for South Asia at Stanford. Again, many thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Let me tell you who else is with us. Here in studio, Sean Randolph is here. He's CEO of the Bay Area Council Economics Institute. They're a private and public partnership of business, labor, government, and higher education, working to support the economic vitality and competitiveness of California and the Bay Area. Welcome, Sean Randall.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you here with us, and also glad to have with us by phone Vivek Wadhwa, who is visiting scholar at UC Berkeley, senior research associate with the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School, and executive in residence and adjunct professor at the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke. He's a senior research associate with the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard and executive in residence adjunct professor at Pratt at Duke. A number of affiliations there, Professor Wadhwa. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin, Sean Randolph, with you. We heard some skepticism on the part of Rafiq Dosani, but the report that you've put out, and there was one on China 3 years ago by Bay Area Council, is quite optimistic. I mean, it looks as if the partnership between the Bay Area and India has never been more solid.
No, that's right, Michael. I'd say that even if India isn't necessarily a strategic country from the standpoint of the U.S. as a whole, and one could talk about that, that it is absolutely strategic from the standpoint of Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. Our web of ties at every level, human, family going back many, many decades, university, professional organizations such as Indus Entrepreneurs that started as a dinner group here and now is 12,000 members and 53 chapters in a dozen countries, to our, especially our tech community, where we have Indian CEOs, Indian technologists who heavily populate the tech community in this region. Nearly every major technology company in the Bay Area has a center for R&D in India. Our companies are deeply invested there, and India is incredibly deeply woven into the fabric of many, many of our companies and their global strategies. So we have the largest Indian community in the United States here in the Bay Area after the New York, New Jersey area. They are wildly successful by any measure, and they are operating as integral parts of our community at an extremely high level. So many of our companies are in India for the Indian market, too. So we're looking at a partnership at a global level, and really there's no place in the U.S. that comes anywhere close to the Bay Area for the density of connections between our economy and theirs.
And that closeness, Vivek Wadhwa, that we're hearing from Sean Randolph, has a lot to do with R&D, obviously.
Yes, in fact, my research is entirely in sync with what Sean is talking about. And when I've been looking at it over the last 2 years or so, it's been amazing to see how much is happening in India. You don't read about it in the newspapers here because companies are afraid of talking about R&D going offshore. But even the most sophisticated technologies, you know, take the Kindle, for example. Key components of that were designed in New Delhi. Key components of the Palm Pre were designed over there. The Motorola's Razor and a lot of new technologies were designed in India. And you can even go into other industries like General Electric. I mean, they're designing next-generation wind turbines in India. They're designing washers and dryers, refrigerators in India. You don't see the extent of it in the United States, but it's just when you go there and see what's happening on the ground, you're just blown away with how integrated the two economies have become.
But we're also seeing a lot of those who came here from India going back to India. There's a kind of brain drain now, isn't there? Because India is doing so well, and whereas at one time they could make a lot more money here, that's not necessarily true anymore.
That's a double-edged sword. Yes, there's been a tendency going back, but we've also had problems with our immigration policies, which are forcing people to go back. But you're absolutely right that Indians have contributed significantly to Silicon Valley, and they've achieved success, and many are going back. They're going back in record numbers, and they're fueling innovation and R&D in India even more.
One of the things I noticed in the report, Sean Randolph, that you put out is the tremendous potential for the domestic market where India is concerned for the United States and particularly for the Bay Area.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people think of India, if you just ask anybody on the street, in terms of offshoring of back office jobs and call centers. But in fact, many of our companies that are in India today are there increasingly to take part in India's domestic market, depending on how you want to measure it, there's somewhere between 200 and 300 million consumers in India who would be called middle class in the sense they have discretionary money to spend, and they are spending it. And so we're finding that Bay Area companies like Levi Strauss, Levi's has, I think, 450 exclusive outlets across India. Software companies like Oracle is the fourth largest market worldwide for India is the fourth largest market worldwide for Oracle. You start to go down the list of Bay Area companies that are there. More and more, their focus is really on India as a future market, and also on India as a platform for jumping into and penetrating other emerging economy markets. So if you can develop a product in India, meaning it has to be cost-effective for that kind of a consumer base that meets the needs of a large developing economy, you can take that almost anywhere else in the world. So it's not just about offshoring anymore, and it's about a lot more than R&D. It's also now about the potential in India's domestic market, just as we're seeing more and more focus on China's domestic market among our companies here.
And again, Sean Randolph is CEO of the Bay Area Council Economics Institute. This is a half-hour segment, which means, once again, that we invite your phone calls. And, in fact, we'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about ongoing relations between the U.S. and India, about particularly where the focus of this report is from the Bay Area Council, the Economics Institute, on ties between the Bay Area and Northern California and India. And if any of you have questions or comments, now's the time to call. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Again, toll-free from anywhere, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786. Or you can send us an email, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. Vivek Wadhwa, what about, where are we now on outsourcing? I mean, you know, for a while there, it seemed like a lot of jobs were being lost because of outsourcing to India.
It's a two-way street. That surprisingly, outsourcing is also happening to America from different parts of the world for lower-level projects. But I want to build on the point that Sean made, which your listeners may not realize, that American companies have globalized. Take HP. 69% of the revenue comes from overseas. 66% of IBM's revenue comes from overseas. 57% of Caterpillar's revenue comes from overseas. So when you start thinking about it, our engineers here are developing technologies for the world over. What India is doing is providing them a beachhead in another part of the world. It's providing them with talent which understands the needs of those markets much better. And this is why our companies are achieving so much success. So there are many other benefits, you know, which go beyond outsourcing.
Such as?
Well, such as being able to develop innovative technologies for the developing world. I'll give you one example. There are a number of intelligent cities being built in Saudi Arabia, in Dubai, in different parts of the Middle East. The average cost is $25 billion. Well, Cisco is developing key infrastructure for those intelligent cities. Now, for the Arabs to come to the United States is not convenient or comfortable. They would rather go to New Delhi or Bangalore to discuss the R&D and discuss what's going on there. So Cisco is using their Bangalore offices as a beachhead to get major contracts in the Middle East.
You want to add something, Sean Randolph?
Just one thing, Michael. India, maybe 7 or 8 years ago when the offshoring really got going, had a tremendous cost advantage. You could hire an engineer there for maybe 20% of the cost of one here. While there's still a big differential, and there's no question but that India is a bargain in terms of the kind of talent you can hire, that it's really shrunken. As they've become more successful, the cost advantage is down to maybe 50%, but that's not 80%. And it does mean that the competitive terms have changed, and actually a lot of offshoring is, I think India will be the number one place in the world for a long time, but it's also going to Eastern Europe and South Africa and the Philippines and many, many other places. So as we talked to nearly 200 companies, most here in the Bay Area in doing this report, we found a lot of really interesting things. But one was absolutely no question offshoring is going to be a fact of life for a long time. But that doesn't mean that if a job is created in India, it's one less job here. In fact, a lot of our companies are using India, as Vivek was saying, as a global platform that are allowing the companies to be more creative and expand globally into those markets. And very often what's happening is they are moving some of their more routine functions, you know, significant but legacy functions, to be managed out of India, which is freeing them to actually focus more and do more hiring here on the more innovative functions that are creating the new projects, the new products, the new services. So there is a certain level of complementarity here when you look at it from a global perspective. perspective.
When you look at global perspective, also I'm thinking about and jobs as well, Vivek Wadhwa, the fact that India is probably, many instances right now, doing a better job as far as math and science education.
Yes, and there's also a focus on engineering that when you graduate, when parents tell their children that they need to become engineers and scientists over there, I haven't heard of any American parents saying that to their kids for a long time. So it's very respectful, it's very prestigious to get into these fields in India. So this is where they're going, and the numbers are increasing quite dramatically. The quality is improving dramatically. The skills are improving dramatically. They're also becoming entrepreneurs. They're also learning from Silicon Valley, from the people you talked about earlier on who are going back, and they're becoming like our Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. So they're going to be standing head-to-head with Silicon Valley, sometimes competing, sometimes cooperating, but more likely it'll be an integrated economy in the future.
Well, let's bring our callers in here, and we'll go first to Philadelphia. Glenn, join us. Good morning.
Thanks very much for taking my call. I wanted to offer a little bit of perspective from a small company point of view. I heard one of the guests mention IBM or HP or something like that. I work for an information technology company where we have operations overseas in the Philippines and a little bit in India. And if we tried to base ourselves entirely in the U.S., it would simply be impossible. And we're a startup. We're 8-9 years old. We have fewer than 100 people in the entire organization. But if we try to do this all out of New York, the headquarters happens to be in Manhattan, it would simply be impossible. So not every job that I think is utilized overseas, I heard someone say, it's not a job lost here. Our company simply wouldn't exist, and we would have never gotten started if we tried to be entirely U.S.-based with all American workers. We wouldn't have the capacity to use the code. We wouldn't have the ability to support the back office infrastructure if we tried to do this all in Manhattan or Silicon Valley or even Philadelphia, whatever it might be.
Yeah, Vivek Wadhwa.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That's exactly what I've been saying, and that's exactly what Sean's fantastic report talks about. That this, people don't understand this. They still think in terms of outsourcing, taking American jobs away, job losses here, and so on. They don't understand how dependent our economy is on global markets right now, and how we need to leverage every asset that we have.
I think the headlines go for the call center in India or something like that. But 9 years ago, a couple of venture capitalists got together. And the model was, you're going to have some of this stuff based overseas on day one.
Well, since you mentioned venture capital, we've got Vivek Paul with us, who is the CEO of Akansa Capital, who's joining us by phone this morning. We'll say good morning to you, Vivek Paul.
Thank you, and pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. Well, Bay Area remains sort of the VC hub of the world, and so the relations with India certainly accrue from that to a great degree, do they not?
Well, absolutely. I think that first of all, the outsourcing to India, just to sort of segue from the previous discussion, has allowed venture capital-backed companies to have a second shot at goal in the sense that, when you have a lower cost, you can actually experiment with more products and ideas. Having said that, I think right now what's really exciting is the fact that you're seeing a lot of Indian companies which are serving the Indian market, but using the talent from the Bay Area for doing the architecture and the market-facing work and the capital from the Bay Area to be able to go after this. And I think that that's, in some sense, the natural logical next step.
So there is a kind of binary between capital from here and labor from there?
Oh, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, India with its 1 billion population, 55% of its work of its labor pool being below 25 years of age, you've got this really nice availability of labor at the same time that many of the industrialized economies are aging. And so we've got the capital here, we've got the labor there. What a wonderful combination.
And we're not competitive as far as industries.
Well, I think that, the thing that you have to look at is, are you starting with a fundamental presumption that there's a fixed lump of labor or a fixed pie to go after? I think that as some of the speakers before me spoke, this creates new opportunities. So when you have a large labor pool, it allows you to do more stuff here. It allows you to address that market there. And the whole pie rises. And it rises much faster than how the slices get sliced. And, I think net-net, everybody comes out ahead.
Well, California economy certainly needs that. You were going to add something here, Sean Randolph?
I was just going to add to what Vivek said, that it's really remarkable if you go to India and you walk into many of the technology companies or you walk into the Indian offices of most of the major venture companies, you'll probably be talking to somebody from the Bay Area. Very often Indian, very often somebody with a degree from an IIT or from Stanford or Berkeley who's had 10 or 15 years of experience here in the Bay Area, and they've gone back either permanently to staff up those companies at a senior level, or they've been assigned by their company here to go and get things going in India, and they're going to come back. So there really is, at the human capital level, a tremendous flow circulating now between the Bay Area and India that's having a lot of influence on the development of India's economy, especially in areas related to technology.
Let me go to more calls, and George joins us from Santa Clara. Good morning.
Good morning. I wanted to make a comment regarding the outsourcing. I understand completely its temporary benefits. So today it's great for companies to be able to ship outside the U.S. Jobs and sell our expertise for cheap. But for tomorrow, it's gutting our economy. It's like, you know, cutting down all the forests that are out there and then wondering why there are no jobs for our children in the future. It's, I think, obscene to use actually pension funds like investing in VCs that put our money in India, China, and other countries. With all due respect, I understand democracy and I understand free markets. But where is it leading? What will our children do?
Yeah, your concern is with the long term, or you're certainly apprehensive about the long term. Vivek Paul?
Well, you know, I think that today where things stand is that the world needs more skilled labor. And so fundamentally, if you think about even right now when we're facing probably worst unemployment situation that we've had in decades. You know, the unemployment rate I saw in the paper was 4% for college graduates. So I think that what's happening is that you have a fundamental shift where unskilled labor in some sense commoditizes, and it's really hard. At the same time, what we're seeing is that in the U.S. particularly, where, you know, you'd expect something different, but really in many parts of the world, the number of graduates who are graduating with engineering or technical degrees is dropping. And it's this coming together of these two events. Now, I'm an optimist, and I feel that, you know, a market like the United States actually reacts. People react, and I think that as we see more of the newer generation driving towards where the jobs lie and where the profitable jobs lie, I think we will see a switch back towards the more skilled labor and more towards technical degrees. But unfortunately, we are seeing that confluence of both events, which is the world's moving to more skilled labor needs, and the labor workforce in the U.S. in the meantime has moved away from that.
And again, Vivek Paul is CEO of Akanza Capital. Let me thank George for the call and move on to another caller from Saratoga. Randy, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've been working here in the Silicon Valley for probably almost 30 years now, and I've seen lots of transformations over those 30 years. I can commend the Indians for building their own infrastructure and building out their own markets. It's a great idea, whose time has come. I'd just like to add a question to the caller, the host here. When will India stop pegging their exchange rate to the U.S. dollar? It makes the U.S. engineer very uncompetitive, and it's anti-free market. And when will India stop doing that and let their currency flow?
Well, you can ask the same question about China in terms of their currency. But Vivek, why don't you want to weigh in here?
Yes, sure. Absolutely. I think that the situation in India is different from China. Unfortunately, and I say this because I'd love to see the Indian rupee actually rise, but the Indian rupee is in some sense free-floating. The reason why the darn thing won't rise against the dollar is because the government is spending money pretty heftily in terms of stimulating the economy. And as a result of the fact that it has to import a lot of oil, it's the fundamental economic pressures that keep the rupee where it is. So it's not really a managed float per se. I mean, it is managed to some degree, but really the rupee right now is sitting at 47. It was at 42 earlier, and the reason why it's weakened against the dollar is not because of a government rent or government-mandated issue, but because of the fundamental economics of deficit spending by the government and the high import bill on oil.
That was, by the way, Vivek Paul. This is the first time I've had two Viveks on at the same time. Vivek Wadhwa, you wanted to say something here.
No, I agree with the other Vivek as well. I mean, Vivek's are pretty smart. Essentially, India, the economy is a free economy, relatively speaking, and the currency rate is reacting to other pressures. So it's not you know, fudged or controlled. It's basically market forces that are at play over here.
Well, Sean Randolph, what about Indian investment in the California economy, particularly since the California economy is so unstable and there may be the possibility actually of our bond rating going the way of the warrior, as we used to say?
Well, our bond rating couldn't be any lower, actually. I think we're the 50th out of 50 states. So.
Until we default, possibly.
Let's not go there if we can help it.
But things are very tenuous and fragile where this economy is concerned in California, given the budget and the deficit in the budget and so forth.
They are. I think, though, looking at Indian investment, it's a little bit like we're seeing with China. But as with everything else, India is maybe 5 or 10 years behind China. So as India is becoming more successful, especially its major companies are becoming very, very successful, it's starting to invest around the world. It's starting to export capital in pretty significant volumes and has been on something of an acquisition spree in the last few years. More things like steel and, you know, the Jaguar in the UK and other things like that. But nevertheless, there is an outward push on India's part right now. Now, as a place that's very culturally comfortable for people from India, as a very dynamic economy, very innovative economy, unique in the world in that respect, this is a really logical place for Indian companies to come and invest, and especially given the technology linkages. So we're starting to see it, very small early days, but I think that's something we should look to for the future as an opportunity.
Well, it behooves me to read an email here. We've been hearing about competition with job creation, and here's a different point of view, a modest disagreement from a listener named Howard, who says, Speaker said that the creation of a job in India doesn't take away from jobs in the United States. I have to disagree. It may be only half of the jobs get exported, but certainly experienced workers from India and other countries compete with me for IT jobs, and I've been without a job for 3 years next month. Lots of recruiting firms with staff having Indian names call me about positions every month, but I never get the interview. Never get an interview, and I have 18 years of IT experience. I think they're comparing me with their own candidates and lower the rate.
You know, I think there's a different dynamic at play over here, which we don't admit to, that in IT, once you get beyond a certain age, once you're making, you know, six-figure salaries, companies can hire people much more cheaply from schools. This has always been the case. I mean, go back 20 years, and I recall that we used to have the same arguments about young, you know, college grads taking away jobs from experienced workers. So it's sad that that's happening, but it's always happened, and it probably always will happen because of the nature of technology. The fact is that technology keeps changing. Young, bright kids out of school always have the advantage.
And we've come to the end of the hour, alas. So I want to thank you, Vivek Wadha, thank Vivek Paul, and thank Sean Randolph, also Rafiq Dasani, who joined us earlier. Also, thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Matthew Colley, Jem Lee Vo, Dimitri Kesselman, and Mariah Dickerson. Another hour ahead, all about city arts and lectures. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.